This summer school, Tuesday, 1st September 1981. Do we all know dukkha? Really know? All of us experience physical pain and psychically grief, heart-rending grief sometimes. But is our experiencing of pain and grief such that all of us want to be rid of it as quickly as possible and perhaps supplant it with exciting pleasure and joy? Pleasure and joy, mark you, not necessarily peace of mind and tranquility of heart. Such being the case, if that were the case, we cannot clearly understand dukkha. Without freedom from attachment, freedom from aversion and from preferential choice, and therefore freedom from bias, prejudice, and unwarranted preconceptions and assumptions, it is not possible to know truly, to understand clearly. If the psyche is empty of all defilements, then pure love, deep compassion springs into action. In the state of communion, a Brahma Viharic state, a divine state, we can know in fullness and perfection. It is love that makes us wise. It is pure love that releases the faculty of unerring insight. Call it buddhi, or use the Platonic word nous, Platonic and Neoplatonic. Out of loving communion is born true conception. And then you cannot go wrong. You are on the right path. That is why truly knowing dukkha out of loving communion, nirvana can manifest itself through you. You sacrificed, that is, made sacred. That's the deep meaning of sacrifice. It would be difficult, perhaps impossible, to meet a man who could, without being self-deluded, honestly declare that he has never experienced dukkha in some form or other. Dukkha is ubiquitous. Although it is universally but superficially known, only a few perceive that the supreme dukkha consists in not being in communion with the one total reality. Dukkha in its psychophysical manifestations is known by everybody, but it is the one who is deeply concerned with living the religious life, whether it is in Buddhistic terms or Christian terms or Hindu terms or any other terms. It is only he who wakes up to the fact that he is not in communion. He, the subject, is separate from the object, which is the rest of the world. And for him, transcendence itself, or if he's a Christian or a theistic Hindu or a Zarathustrian, God is something which is an object to be sought, to be obtained. Only a few perceive that the supreme dukkha consists in not being in communion with the one total reality, in not being fully awakened, fully enlightened, truly human. All the great teachers in India, and all the great spiritual teachers elsewhere too, presented dukkha as samsara, but particularly in India, samsara, the cycle of births and deaths, as it is called. They also presented dukkha as old age, decrepitude and decay, sorrow and ignorance, the state of ignorance, avidya. Avidya really means not seeing, because the word is derived from the root vid, meaning to see, not seeing. And if one does not see, then one is in the state of ignorance. And one's whole consciousness, one's mode of awareness of existence, is in a conditioned, confused, and worldly state. In The Heart of Religion, on page 156, note 14, I have given a very complete reference to all the different Upanishads and so on, where this is stated. Now, the first Ariya Satya, the noble truth, first noble truth of the Buddha, states that dukkha consists in jati. I'm deliberately using the word jati, sometimes often translated as birth or rebirth. Aging and dying, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair, association with the disliked, separation from the liked, not obtaining what one wants, in short, the five aggregates, the five khandhas, as they are called, constituting the existential person. I think you all know the five khandhas: rupa, vedna, sanya, sankhara, vijnana. And this particular description of the first noble truth comes in the second volume of the Digha Nikaya, in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. It's practically at the end, it's one but the last in the end of the book, towards the end of the book. And that's about the, sutta gives about the fullest description of the four noble truths as such, and the distinct definitions of the words which are used. There is an amusing aspect to those definitions, because the words are put in the mouth of the Buddha. If he's defining grief, he will use the same word in the course of the definition. However, it's a sutta which is most worthwhile studying. The actual Satipatthana part comes in full in the Majjhima Nikaya too. But in the Digha, in addition to the full Satipatthana sutta, there is also the statement of the Four Noble Truths and a few other things like that, you see. Now, jati is popularly regarded as birth and rebirth, as an immense cycle of incarnations. But note carefully, what is said in the Visuddhi Magga of Buddha Ghosha, translated by Nyanamoli. In his translation, it's on pages 625 and 6. And I've got it here, and I'll read it. Buddha Ghosha says, when a man is confused about death, instead of taking death thus, death in every case is a breakup of aggregates, that is the khandhas. It's a breakup of the khandhas in every case. The man who is confused figures that it is a lasting being that dies, that it is a lasting being's transmigration to another incarnation, and so on. When he is confused about reappearance, meaning birth, instead of taking rebirth thus, birth in every case is a manifestation of aggregates. He figures that it is a lasting being's manifestation in a new body. When he is confused about the round of rebirths, instead of taking the round of rebirths as pictured thus, the endless chain of aggregates, of elements, of bases that carries on unbrokenly is what is called the round of births. He figures that it is a lasting being that goes from this world to another world, that comes from another world to this world. Now I commend that statement for deep consideration to everyone. In every case, birth and death are an appearance of the aggregates, of the khandhas as such, and death is the breakup of the khandhas in every case, and have nothing to do with a particular lasting being from incarnation to incarnation. It is a very, very important statement, actually. Again, Narada Thera, in his Manual of Abhidhamma, states, jati, birth or rebirth, as commonly translated, strictly speaking, is the arising of the aggregates. Note also what is said of samsara, commonly defined as the cycle of births and deaths, of samsara, the becoming process, in the Maitri Upanishad. It comes in the 6th chapter, section 34. Samsara is just one's own thought process. With effort, one should cleanse it. In the Shandilya Upanishad, it is stated, when the fluctuations of the mind, the mana spanda, cease, this cycle of births and deaths comes to an end. When the fluctuations of the... the translator uses the word mind, where he would more profitably have used the word psyche. Or used chitta, meaning attentiveness, attention. You know how attention flits from here to there, from one subject to another subject, and so on. In the Maitreya Upanishad, to be distinguished from the Maitri, and also from the Maitreyani, there are three very similar names to these Upanishads, it is mind, chitta alone, which is samsara. not a cycle of births and deaths of the same individual being as such, who was a particular being in his life. These things which are given out in the Upanishads are the esoteric teachings, actually. The mass of the people just had the popular belief that I come back again and again. I had so many previous lives, whatever that word I meant. And so many people in the popular sense would say, oh, it's my Atma coming, taking on incarnation after incarnation. My Atma. My bit of transcendence. My bit of the infinite, eternal and the immortal. You see the complete absurdity of it. Let us consider a few points. Oh, and one more. Patanjali, in the yoga aphorisms, starts off with the statement, yogas chitta nivritti chitta vritti nirodha. Yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Chitta vritti are these fluctuations of one's consciousness, one's attention, and the fluctuations which take place in your mind. It's very instructive to study these things in depth. Let us consider a few points in this connection. If the body had no nervous system and a brain possessing its receptive, responsive sensitivity, neither pain nor pleasure could be experienced. Have you ever thought of this? The body minus a nervous system and a brain possessing this receptive, responsive sensitivity, neither pain nor pleasure could be experienced. If there were no psyche, neither sorrow nor joy, the psychical correspondence of physical pain or pleasure could be known. When you have a pleasurable sensation, it's the psyche that says, yes, I have had a pleasurable sensation. And if it's a painful sensation, the psyche knows that. And the pleasurable sensation is joy, the unpleasurable sensation is sorrow. We saw last Sunday that although the psyche is rooted in matter, it is permeated through and through by pure mind. Recall what I said. Pure mind, this cosmic energy interacting with body, gives rise to psyche. All our mental processes, as we call them, our thoughts, our feelings, our moods, and all the rest of it. If the psyche did not have the influence of pure mind in it, no ultimately true perception of dukkha, and especially of that aspect of dukkha, shoka, transcendental sorrow, the transcendental sorrow of our not being in communion would not be possible. It is because that cosmic element of pure mind in its purity is also present in the psyche that it is possible for us to have the vision, to get the glimpse of that which is truth in the supreme sense. There could be no panya, unerring insight of the transcendent context of the infinite, eternal and immortal, and deeper still, of the unitary wholeness, transcendence itself, and of our unbreakable containment within it, and therefore of the purpose of our existence, the purpose of dukkha, our dukkha, and the process of our evolutionary and developmental growth, which culminates in our total restoration into transcendence. Those of you who are really interested in yoga, not merely as a keep fit system, but in yoga proper, will find at the end of Patanjali's work the statement that when the complete thing has been done, of which the physical asanas and the pranayama are only a part, an indispensable part, the physical basis only. All the rest is the most important part, is what follows: dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, but by which one realizes the complete communion with the total reality. And then you are in the state of kaivalya, the kaivalya state, which is the alone, the state of the alone. Now don't misunderstand the term alone. The alone in this context means the one only. What is the one only? The one total reality. It does not mean loneliness. Alone, the word alone doesn't mean loneliness in this sense. The transcendence is the alone, and you completely restored to that transcendence, are also the alone. And that transcendent aloneness, oneness, is manifested through you, the living yogi. Although you, the living yogi, are a finite, temporal, and mortal existential being. We are like rivers. The sun's warmth evaporates the ocean waters, rain falls, and rivers flow. And as the rivers flow, they finally meet with the self-same ocean waters, and we, of course, are released from the shackles of separate identity and commingle with the totality in blissful play. Thus, we can see clearly, if there is no psyche, there is no dukkha. If there is no psyche, there is no purification work to be done, treading the way to liberation. It's very important to bear this in mind. The psyche is the important element in this whole thing. The Buddha, the Lord of compassion and wisdom, was one of the supreme healers of the sick psyche. He was the true great psychiatrist. Why do I say this? How was it so? Recall the story told in the first volume of the Jataka, from page 75 onwards, of how the Buddha spent 7 days looking at the spot on which he sat at the foot of the tree of enlightenment. Now, I expect some of you may be interested in botany, but however great your interest, do you spend 7 days staring at the root of a tree? What is this tree? It is your own brain and nervous system and all your psychical functioning. I said yesterday, didn't I? The body is the Garden of Eden. The tree of life is this, actually. So he sat looking at it, examining this psyche of his, which was now completely emptied of all defilements, completely emptied of all fixations, all particular concepts, ideas, convictions, beliefs, and the whole lot. They were clean out. And this is a phenomenon which is extraordinary altogether. Which one of us has a psyche like that, which is absolutely empty and therefore unobstructive to the light of transcendence, absolutely transparent to the supreme reality? That's what he was looking at. And he spent 7 days in meditation looking at it. The 7 days, I suppose, is just, you know, they always use some figure like that. Thus, because he fully understood both the sick psyche and the pure psyche, he himself had been through the stages of the ordinary human being, like you and I, you see. And he knew what the sick psyche was like, because he lived like an ordinary human being until that in him which aspired to the supreme truth made him go away from home, and for 6 years spent his time and reached enlightenment, you see. And therefore, because he understood both the sick psyche and the pure psyche, he had the power and ability to heal all who came to him, all who came to him to be healed. Where a physical ailment is concerned, one can go to a doctor, a qualified doctor, another human being like myself, I could go to him, and he could diagnose what my physical ailment is and prescribe a remedy which the chemist or whoever it is will give me. And if I take it, I may get well. Sometimes I may not get well. Now, a physical doctor can do, a doctor can do that physically. But in the case of the psyche, it is a little bit different. The diagnosis of the psychical illness is also the remedy. If you truly diagnose what your own psychical ailment is, if you truly diagnose it, the light of understanding affects the healing of it. The complete understanding heals the psychical ailment. So if you go to somebody else and he is supposed to be able to heal you, he himself has to be completely purified. He has to be like the Buddha or like Jesus or like Krishna or whoever the perfected Holy One may be. Because his psychical influence is absolutely perfect, and he knows how to effect the healing, and he will help the sick person, the person with a sick psyche, to know himself. And in knowing himself truly, he becomes whole and healed. He's cured of his blindness, his lameness, his dumbness, his deafness. Interpret the miracles of Jesus, most of them anyway, in that way, and you will find much enlightenment. Now, The Udana and also the Mahavagga begin with an account of what happened soon after the Enlightenment. For the first 7 days, the Buddha sat motionless at the foot of the tree of awakening, experiencing the bliss of freedom. You might wonder, was he indulging himself, having a good time, enjoying the bliss of the bliss of freedom? No. In that supreme state of meditation, the supreme state that human beings can ever realize, there is a gathering of energies, of transcendent energy, which belongs to the context of the infinite, eternal and immortal, and that energy is self-replenishing. This is a very important point to bear in mind. The pure spiritual energy is a self-replenishing energy. If somebody questions in a simple way, how does God sustain himself? God is creative energy of such a nature that it replenishes itself. It is self-subsistent, self-existent. It is, to put it in one word, an aseity, A-S-E-I-T-Y. It's an aseity, you see. So, the perfected Holy One is charged with this energy by remaining in that supreme state of meditation. And charged with this energy, the whole psychophysical organism also becomes charged with that energy. And later on, you hear about how he goes to what is commonly called the Ajapala tree, translated as the goat herd's banyan tree. I prefer to translate it as the tree of him who tends the unborn. Aja also means unborn, not only goat. Ajapala, the tender of the unborn, the Ajapala tree. And then he goes to the Muchalinda tree and then to the Rajayatana tree. And then he comes back to the goatherd's tree. Now what happens in the course of this meditation? He discovers in what manner the teaching could be presented in terms which are suitable for psychophysical organisms. Charged with the spiritual power, the transcendent power, as well as with the pure knowledge of how to deal with mankind, then he can be the perfect teacher. And then, you know, after that, there comes the feeling in him, it would be a weariness and vexation to me if I were to try to teach people and they wouldn't listen, and they were not likely to listen because they were absolutely imprisoned by their passion for pleasure and the murk, and covered by the murk of ignorance, as he called it. And then Brahma makes the entreaty and the Buddha finally agrees. So after that, those first 7 days where he enjoyed the bliss of freedom, the next day, during the night, during the three watches of the first night, he paid close attention to causal apprising, as it is called, during the first watch in direct order, during the second watch in reverse order, and in both direct and reverse order during the third watch. The doctrine of causal apprising, the Paticchasamuppada, as it is called, is of very, very great importance. It lies at the heart of the Buddha Dhamma. It is also termed dependent origination by some scholars. Dr. Iseline Horner used the term conditioned genesis, and Dr. Konza, both Dr. Horner and Dr. Konza are dead now, he called it conditioned co-production. I think that's a very good translation. Conditioned co-production. Co-production. With conditioned genesis, you would say, oh, this gives brings about that, and that brings about that, and so on. But co-production, everything is produced at the same time, actually. And Dr. Konza, in that masterpiece of his entitled Buddhism, little book, on page 48, calls this Paticca-samuppada an important corollary to the Four Truths. It runs as follows, and I'm choosing the presentation in the Udana rather than in the Mahavagga, because in the Udana, the basic principle is stated first. Now, on that occasion, that is, after the Enlightenment, the Exalted One was seated for 7 days in one posture and experienced the bliss of release. Then the Exalted One, during the first watch of the night, rousing himself from that concentration of mind, gave close attention to causal uprising in direct order, thus, this being that becomes. By the arising of this, that arises. Namely, conditioned by ignorance, the activities arise. Conditioned by activities, consciousness. Vijnana is the word used. Conditioned by consciousness, mind and body, nama rupa. Conditioned by mind and body, the six sense spheres. One may ask, how six sense spheres? India, of course, has always seen that the five senses which we have physically are physical senses. But for India, the ability for discursive thought, our logical discursive thinking process, that aspect of mind they call material and not immaterial. You see? And that is the sixth sense. Because by our logical discursive process, we make various deductions which affect our life in a manner similar to the way in which our life is affected by the operation of the five physical senses as such. So, the six... Yes, conditioned by nama rupa, mind and body, the six sense spheres. Conditioned by the six spheres, sense spheres, there is contact, fassa. You may say contact, or you may use the word impression. Impression may be a more convenient word to use. Conditioned by impression, there is feeling. Conditioned by feeling, there arises craving. The thing which we like very, very much, we want more and more of it. We crave for it. So craving arises that way. Conditioned by craving, there is grasping, upadana, the stretching out of your hand to get what you crave for. Conditioned by grasping, there is a becoming. Conditioned by becoming, bhava, there is birth. coming into being actually, therefore. Conditioned by birth, old age and death, jara marana, grief, lamentation, suffering, sorrow and despair come into being. Thus is the arising of this mass of ill. That's how the Udana puts it. And all this, which is the 12th, there are 12 steps here, the 12 nidanas as they are called. And this last nidana, jara marana, is associated with suffering, sorrow, despair and so forth. Soka parideva dukha domanasa upasaya. You see. Then, when he goes through the same thing in reverse order, he looks at it in this way. This not being, that becomes not. By the ceasing of this, that ceases to be. Therefore, by the ceasing of avidya, ignorance, there is the ceasing of the sankharas. By the ceasing of the sankharas, there is the ceasing of vijnana. Vijnana in this context may also be translated as mental continuum. Not only your own discriminative consciousness, as mental continuum. And so you go through the whole series again and end up with saying that if there is no jati, there is no jara marana, etc., etc. Such is the nirodha. Nirodha means the utter ceasing or fading away or extinction of this mass of ill. And in the third watch, he goes through both the orders. In the direct order, this being that arises, and also this not being that does not become. Now, notice it is said that the Buddha paid close attention. What might a Buddha's close attention mean? It's not discursive thinking. Remember, he is in the profound meditative state in which he remains for a long time, for days and days. In the silence, it may well mean that he is in the silence of the second jhana and onwards. Now, what is this silence of the second jhana? It is the complete cessation of all discursive thought. Vittakka and vichara have completely subsided. And consciousness is functioning on its own plane, unhindered, unobstructed by all the limitations of the psychophysical organic functioning. This is what is meant by paying close attention. Ordinarily, we read a thing like that and we think of, oh, concentrating his brain upon it. Not at all. The brain is quiet now. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't interfere. Therefore, archetypal pure mind is able to function freely through the empty, transparent psyche. Brain cells undergo transformation. The unconditioned state is realized. And it is in this state that he pays close attention to this causal uprising process as such. I think we'll stop there for the present. Now this teaching of the Paticca-samuppada has been a headache for almost all scholars. It's very difficult really to fit it into any sort of logical scheme which would satisfy us as we are in the ordinary state. The usual explanation of this doctrine has been given in terms... The usual explanation has been given in terms of past lives, the present life and future life. That is the usual explanation which has been given, especially in India, by the Pali scholars and so forth. But unless one can make some sort of, produce some sort of sensible explanation, the Paticca-samuppada is useless to us as such. There are peculiarities in the way in which it is presented. Let us look at it. The critical point in the reverse order is the statement that by the ceasing of vijnana, that is consciousness, there is the extinction of nama-rupa, the psychophysical organism. That is the ordinary meaning. Now, does nama-rupa, in this teaching, as given by the Buddha originally, stand for the existential being, you, the psychophysical person? If it does, if it means your death with the extinction of vijnana, then all the other nidanas, the factors composing the Paticca-samuppada, are wiped out. Isn't that so? Once you, the person who is alive, is dead, is extinguished, your vijnana, your consciousness, your whole body and everything, you're dead. Well, where is the point of the other factors? There can be no sense functioning, there can be no impression, there can be no sensation, there can be no craving or grasping or contact or any sort of jati as such. Now, I found this a very, very difficult thing altogether, and I spent a lot of time trying to make some sense of the thing as it stands. If we consider it very carefully, we must bear in mind that the Buddha was concerned with the psyche, with the mind, all the time. He was the healer of the mind. He was the doctor, the teacher of the mind. Surely then, the Paticca-samuppada is concerned with the thought process, just as suggested in the Upanishads. Samsara is just your own thought process. Surely then, the ceaseless manaspanda, as in the Chandilya Upanishad, or Chitta Vritti, as in Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, which is the ill state. We have seen earlier on, no psyche, no dukkha. The impurity and imperfection of the psyche is the source of the whole tragedy which we name dukkha. And the Paticca-samuppada reveals the rationale of this dukkha process. It is concerned with your thought process. It exposes the rationale of the thought process, thereby laying bare the mechanism of dukkha, of the sick psyche. Clearly then, nama-rupa refers to the shape of the thought or feeling, which is, the shape of it is the rupa, and its verbal description is the nama. Look at it that way. The verbal description by which we recognize the psychical disturbance. Thought or feeling can utterly fade away without the living person being extinguished. Now perhaps we can begin to make a matter-of-fact, sensible statement in this connection. And in this book, I expressed it this way, which was very much appreciated by, I don't know whether he's still alive, Dr. Friedman, who at that time was the reader in Sanskrit at the London School of Oriental Studies. And he appreciated it very much and said so in his review of this book. Because of ignorance, avidya, there is the predisposition, the sankharas are your predispositions and so on, is the predisposition to that kind of awareness, vijnana, of any object or situation or train of thought or fantasy, which, operating through the appropriate fields of sense, leads to those contacts and impressions which produce which produce sensations, out of which, as a hard core, arises the craving which impels one to grasp at the desired objects, physical or mental, thus giving rise to the formative process, bhava, culminating in either frustration for various reasons, thus ending directly in jaramarana, or in obtaining the object of craving, which because of the law, whatever arises of necessity deceases, ends in loss, suffering, dissolution, death, ill. It's a terrifically long sentence, but I think if you were to look at it carefully, you'll find that it does make sense for a person like me at my level of awareness. You see, it does make sense, and it will make sense only if we treat the Paticchasamuppada as an exposition of the thought process which spells all our ill. Now, there is another way we can look at it. The Buddha always started off with tanha, craving. How to cure this ill state, which the rationale of which is expressed by the Paticchasamuppada. Where do you start here in these 12 factors? We can't start with ignorance, because ignorance is just ignorance. You can't substitute knowledge for ignorance, and all worldly knowledge is utterly useless. Remember the root of the word avidya. It's vidya. It is vid, meaning to see the truth. How do you see the truth? What is the meaning of seeing the truth? It is not just a case of getting an idea or getting a correct description. It is being completely at one with the truth in full consciousness. When you really see, when you are really awakened, you are that which you have seen. You have become that. Recall what we said, what we saw the other day, when Kachana the Great, the Lord has become knowledge, become vision, become Dhamma, become Brahma. And he uses the word Brahma there in the Upanishadic sense. Brahman, the absolute all. You see, You become that which you have truly seen and understood and realized. It's very difficult to use words here. I used the word understood just now. And we have a particular meaning of understanding. It's brain knowledge. This is not just brain knowledge. This is something really quite indescribable. You are that which you have seen. That is why in the Upanishads, when those perfected holy ones realize the Supreme, they unashamedly declared, "I am Brahman." We would, in our day and age, say, what conceited people these were. It's nothing of the sort. It was the statement of a simple fact. Aham Brahmasmi. Aham is I. Brahma, Brahman, Asmi, am. You see, I am Brahman. Now, the word aham does not mean I in our sense of the word I. When we say I, we are just using a simple word, simple sound, to express our self-conception, our self-awareness. You see? All right. This I is completely transcended. When Kumara the Kartikeya asks his father, Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, certain questions about himself, one of the wonderful things that Shiva says is, I am the I which has given up I. I mean, these things need deep meditation, real meditation in the real sense, not churning up thoughts inside the brain. That's no use. But meditation in the real sense, when all the brain activity as such is calmed and all the senses are also perfectly pacified. You see? Now, the word aham is used by those sages and teachers. It is also constantly used by the Buddha. He's constantly using the word I. Aham, he says. This aham can be understood as the unabandonable. That which cannot be abandoned. We can abandon this, that, or the other quality or trait in our nature and so forth. We can abandon ill-doing, wrongdoing, physically, emotionally, and so forth. We can abandon all that. But we can't abandon this transcendent I. The Buddha had become Brahma, remember, the Supreme, the Absolute. Now, you can't abandon it. And therefore, when he speaks always from that transcendent level to the people who are at a very different stage of awareness. You get the point? So, we have this extraordinary situation. So the Buddha is the perfectly enlightened. There is complete vidya, awakening, the full state of enlightenment. He is the alone, the one only. Not the lonely one, but the one only. The absolute all, in fact, in that state of consciousness. Now, being in that state of vidya means that the whole developmental process has come to its fulfillment. We can't start with that ourselves because of what we are at present. But where can we start? And the Buddha, with his superb psychological sense and wisdom, pointed out that craving is the point where you can start and finish off this circle of sorrow, all the factors which make for the ill state exposed in the Paticchasamuppada. Craving. Start with craving. That is what we can be aware of very intensely. We know what we crave for all the time. I want this, I like that, I'm going to have it, and all the rest of it. You see, that is where we can start. And if we start from there, then we can become free of all the other imprisoning factors which compose the Paticchasamuppada. But they won't go in the order in which they are given. You work it out for yourselves. Look up your Paticchasamuppada in some of the textbooks and put all those items down and put them in a circle. That will be better than putting them down one after the other. And then see what happens. With the disappearance of craving, there is the disappearance of wanting to grasp this, that or the other. And many other things will emerge. You will find much enlightenment that way. Now, Dr. Konzer's term, conditioned co-production, is also very helpful. Perhaps this will be of some use to you. Arrange the nidanas in a circle like a pack of cards leaning on each other. You see? Now, you know, if you can arrange a pack of cards, of 12 cards, in a circle leaning on each other, and you just tap one of them, the whole lot will go down like that. You've seen on TV conjurers doing that trick, you know, and the whole thing goes down like that, in one big clatter. Now, arrange the nidanas that way. Touch those nidanas at vijnana, that is the best point. Or you can touch any one of the other nidanas and you'll find that the whole thing will vanish. You see, it will all fall flat. This is because no one factor depends only upon one other factor. Each factor depends upon all the other factors, and all the factors depend upon the one factor also. This Paticchasamuppada has always been a wonderful muddle, really. But it can yield good fruit if you spend the time and take the trouble to look into it very carefully. So, which nidana can we, as we are, touch? We can't touch the wrong nidana because we are limited. And tanha is the best nidana to touch, you see. Start from there. Again, be free of the use of the word nirodha as extinction. Extinction is a wrong word to use. It's true that the enlightened one himself used the word nirodha. Extinction is the wrong word to use simply because there is nothing in the universe that can be annihilated. The totality everlastingly remains the totality. What you can do is to transform, to transmute any one part of it. If you think that you have extinguished something, say for instance, you are a warrior and you have an enemy and you fight with him and kill him and you think you have extinguished him. What happens to you when you wake up after a dream in which you see him again? Have you ever experienced that sort of thing? Put yourself back in time into the position of primitive tribes. When the big chief had slain his enemy, And then some time later, he dreamt that that one whom he had killed was there. And you know how it is in a dream. You find yourself extraordinarily incapable. You can't run, you can't escape, you can't do anything at all. All sorts of queer things happen. And when you wake up, you would be terrified, wouldn't you? You'd start wondering, is my enemy dead? Or is he really alive in some form or other and will come at me again? You see? You have to think of all these things. So don't use the word extinction. All you can do really is to transmute, to transform. You remember yesterday when we were talking about karma, we saw how justice was defined by Aristotle and Plato, and what Jesus and the Buddha both taught with respect to one's behavior towards a person who was harming us. That perfect love, that perfect understanding, which transforms, transmutes the hate and the evil in the other. You see. That is what we can do. And that is the truly positive and creative way of dealing with all our difficulties. Don't try to smash anything up. You'll only hurt yourself. You'll store up trouble somewhere. Look at the state of Iran today and what's happening there. It's a wonderful example of the wrong method. Iran was the land where Zarathustra flourished. And in one of the great teachings of Zarathustra, he says distinctly, put aside all instruments of destruction, all warfare. That was Zarathustrian Iran which flourished. We Parsis, said he with great pride, we Parsis, who number only 120,000 in the whole world, are the descendants of those old Zarathustrian Iranians. But now it is different in Iran. Iran has turned Muslim after the conquest of the third Persian Empire, Iranian Empire, by the Arabs who invaded, and things have changed. That happened 1300 years ago. So, not extinction, but transformation. Transformation. And for transformation, one needs patience, forbearance, and true love, not an enforced love. I ought to be loving, and the way to act if I'm loving is such and such. You will always find that will fail in the long run. It must be a true understanding. This is why it is so that is why I started today's talk by saying, do we truly know dukkha? Do we truly understand it? Because if one truly knows, truly understands, then one has complete compassion and true love operating. And then the right thing happens. Isn't that just what the Buddha did? Because of his discipline and all that he went through and the complete purification of himself, he released this power of Mahakaruna. And coupled with, which is inevitably and invariably coupled with Mahaprajna. The two always go together. You can't have the one by itself. There are two aspects, two views or two visions of the one truth, the one reality. So that way we can deal with the paticca-samuppada. I can't do any better than that in this connection. But regard it, the simple thing is, regard it as your own thought process. When I say thought process, your own psychical process, your thoughts and your feelings and the instinctive reactions which come up in answer to the impressions that come to us or whatever happens to us and so forth. You see? Now let me try and deal with some of these questions. I'll deal with that tomorrow because it's rich. It's a rich question. One needs a long time for it. The question is, why does A get killed in an earthquake and not B if it is not his karma? I expect that the word karma here is used in the meaning of a consequence or something which is deserved by B. The universal process is not ruled by rigid law. There is the element of flexibility, of elasticity throughout the universal process. If there weren't, the entire universal process would be a ghastly mechanical process altogether. It would be not only utterly inhuman, it would be ungodly. There is the play of chance and accident in the universal process. I know I have had friends, some of whom are dead now, of course. I'm the only old one left of that group, who had fought in the First World War, who had experienced the extraordinary event when the Germans were bombarding and shooting at the Allied troops. A person who is standing here at this moment, and a shell just absolutely takes away the man next to him. It's a terrific experience. Why takes away him and not this man himself? One asks the question, why? The question, why, is a wrong question in that context. It just happens that way by virtue of the whole situation. We have to take into account always everything in terms of the whole situation. If we try to single out a particular thing and try to discover everything about it, we will fail. Modern science itself today knows and has stated outright that if you want to know everything about any one particular thing, you have to know all about everything else in the cosmos. They have discovered the extraordinary interactiveness and interdependence of the entire cosmos. And in this cosmos, there is always flexibility and elasticity, and in that within that flexibility and elasticity, there is the play of chance and accident. I happen to stand here, and my friend happened to stand there, and lo and behold, the shell took me off, just like that. It wasn't my karma. I'm a good chap, you know. I didn't do anything to deserve that, either in this life or in a mythical past life. By the way, I'll talk about that very controversial subject tomorrow. So somebody has asked me to deal with it, about this meaning of rebirth. You have already heard what Buddha Ghosha said about birth and rebirth. So it is not a question of karma at all. It happens that way. There are so many things which happen in a certain way, and we can't fit them into a rigid, watertight system of explanations.
Or we just accept everything that happens. Then we get fatalistic.
No. It's not fatalistic at all.
Why is the wrong question? What question should we ask?
How? Investigate the how it happens. That's much more important than inquiring why it happens. Then the next question is, how do we start with transcendence? Quite a few people have the same question. Yes, they do. Here is the same question put in this form. You said that since we are in a state of confusion, we should not begin from where we are, but should start from transcendence. Yes, look. If I start investigating in the right way, from where I am, all my conditioning, all my preconceptions and assumptions and prejudices and biases and all my limitations will play their part and interfere with the investigation. The psyche has to be quiet. The brain has to be quiet. Now, for example, this business of the brain being quiet. When somebody is talking to me, what is my brain doing? I don't mean thereby that is exactly what I do always. But ordinarily, what is my brain doing? It's talking back at him as he is speaking. It's saying, no, I don't agree with you, that's nonsense. Or I say, that's a great idea, I must use it. Appropriately, I'm a thief, I'm appropriating your idea, you see, and so forth. No, that is what the brain is doing in the ordinary way. If one gives one's whole attention, if one can do it, one has to cultivate this, you see, by practice. If one gives one's whole attention to what the other person is saying, then one's own psyche and sense functions and the brain, they are all quiet. They are receiving. They are receiving everything that you are trying to communicate to me. You see, this is the meaning of accepting. This is the kind of acceptance, and then one reflects upon, works upon what has been received, and then one can say something again. You see, in reply. Now, this if we start that way. Then we shall find that we will discover all our drawbacks and difficulties and so forth. So, since this is the case, where all the deep things are concerned, to obtain insight into truth, into reality, in the profound sense, we must start by being quiet ourselves, you see, and then that which is transcendent will make the right sort of impression upon us. So that's what I mean by saying start from transcendence. All this is in relationship with transcendence itself, all the time, with the totality. You remember the other day I talked about the point, the line, the surface, the solid object and so forth, and showed how the infinite and the eternal by self-limitation produces the finite and the temporal. You see? So that what we talk of in terms of two contexts are in ultimate reality one unitarily whole context only. One single total reality. You see? So now, realizing that if this which is limited, finite, is quiet, then the infinite and the eternal and the immortal, which has restricted itself, constricted itself in order to produce the finite and the temporal, is free to make its impression upon the finite and the temporal. And that way, one has deeper insight into truth. This, I admit that this is my own sort of presentation. This is how I see it. So, start from the transcendent in that sense. Just get quiet. You know how the Christian mystics say that put it before God. Now, when the Christian mystic talks in that manner, what he really means is that he becomes so quiet and he just waits peacefully. And reality speaks to him. It's not at all easy. It's very difficult. But it will happen, I assure you it will happen, if you persevere and are patient and are sensible about it. And the greatest good sense involved in it is just this: have no vested interest. Have no vested interest about it. Have no particular something which you are seeking. If you are going to seek something particular, well, the Lord God may have something quite the opposite to tell you as far as the truth is concerned. Then what will you do? Throw it out of the window? So you have to be quiet and be ready to accept the truth as it emerges. But don't deceive yourself that God speaks to me or the transcendent has given me a message or a particular mission. That's all rubbish. As and when you yourself are the perfected Holy One, then you will have the right message from the transcendent and the right mission entrusted to you. But not till then. So be very careful to avoid all sorts of false self-esteem. Is that sufficient answer?
Well, can you make a comment here that to try and assimilate the other techniques of meditation, you know, the more established ones of watching your breathing or mantra, isn't almost the same here of trying to still the mind first? They are a help to stilling the mind from whence your transcendence will arise. The orthodox rules of meditation are nevertheless still valid towards developing towards that state, is it not?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear very clearly and I couldn't follow. Look, we better talk about this privately by ourselves. Because obviously you are serious about finding out about these things. Please remember that I'm getting deafer and deafer as the years pass now. This year, I couldn't hear quite half of what was said at the evening talks. Pardon?
Set your luck.